All right.
We're ready. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Lou, you ready? We have a presentation. Is he going to do it? There he goes. We're going to start off with a presentation from Bill Summerall, VMS presentation.
Good morning. Again, my name is Bill Semro, and I'm with the NOAA Fisheries Office of Law Enforcement. I'm the VMS program manager. I run the VMS team in the Northeast. Some of you have probably talked to Linda Galvin or Bethany Brosnan or Patty Acero. They work for me. I've been with NOAA Fisheries now for 2 years. Prior to that, I served on active duty in the U.S. Coast Guard for 26 years. I'm going to work through this brief at a pretty fast clip. I know it's getting toward lunchtime, and I've been asked to keep this to 30 minutes. We'll see how well I do. This brief is designed to provide an overview of VMS reporting requirements in the Northeast region, and I'll also cover some of the current VMS capabilities and limitations. As the slide shows, there are three vendors approved in the Northeast. Their equipment is shown there. On the left side is the Botrax unit. Botrax is out of San Diego, California. In the middle is Tron and Tron. That company is out of Virginia Beach, Virginia. And on the right is SkyMate, out of Chantilly, Virginia. There is a fourth vendor that's requested Northeast type approval, and that company is called Faria, out of the New London, Connecticut area. And we're currently testing their unit. Next slide. Currently, the Northeast fleet comprises 1,582 vessels. This slide shows the breakdown by both vendor and permit category. Since many vessels hold multiple permits, for the purposes of this report, OLE assigns a vessel to a permit category based on the most restrictive VMS reporting requirement. For example, a vessel holding a general category 1B permit and a multi-species days at sea permit is assigned to the multi-species category since these vessels must report continuously. The VMS fleet has more than doubled since October of 2005 from just over 700 to almost 1,600 today. Since the implementation of Framework 42 last November, there are now 12 screens viewable on the fisherman's VMS unit. There are four declaration screens to declare the intended fishing activity, whether that's multi-species, scallop, monkfish, herring, or the DOF declare out of fishery. A declaration is required prior to leaving the dock or mooring on every trip. That requirement was emphasized in a March 7th permit holder letter sent out by the regional office. There are two catch report forms required to be submitted daily by 9 a.m. local for the previous calendar day's catch, even if there was no fishing activity. Those are for multi-species and scallop if you fish in the U.S.-Canada management area or the SAPs. There are also six other VMS forms that must be sent as the situation requires. They are the differential area layover form. That form is sent from sea when the vessel needs to lay over in the Gulf of Maine or southern New England differential accounting area due to weather or some other event beyond your control. The form is not sent if you're simply transiting through the area or you're declared into that area through the VMS unit. The herring pre-landing form is sent at least 6 hours prior to landing to notify NIMS of your intended ETA and landing port. The cod running clock is sent before crossing the demarcation line on the return trip if the vessel has more cod on board than its days at sea clock will account for. This form is not sent if you're declared into the Gulf of Maine or southern New England differential area. The scallop broken trip form is sent at sea prior to leaving the access area when a limited access scalloper must terminate an access area trip early before the full trip limit is caught. The form and the trip adjustment sheet must be sent to NIMS in order to receive a compensation trip. And the scallop compensation trip form is sent before sailing and requires the fisherman to enter the trip ID numbers from the NIMS letter of authorization. And finally, the Gulf of Maine cod trip limit exemption form is sent before sailing to declare your intent to fish south of the Gulf of Maine RMA and be exempt from the Gulf of Maine cod trip limit and subject to the Georges Bank trip limit instead. This is an example of the VMS declaration screen for a scallop. Those that have a SkyMate unit, this will look very familiar to you. SkyMate employs drop-down menus. As you choose a menu option, additional valid options appear. Tron and Tron also employs a drop-down feature, but the format is a little different. Both the SkyMate and the Tron VMS units drive the user to make a valid VMS declaration code. Boatrax displays the entire screen to the user. There is no logic up front that drives the user to a valid code. That is why Boatrax must send back either a rejection or an approval of a code. So, therefore, Boatrax users must be very cautious in choosing the correct combination of menu options on their macro screen. It's very important that the fishermen make an accurate declaration that reflects their intended activity. It is also important that they routinely check their VMS to ensure that it is positioning normally. Accurate declarations and regular position reports drive trip accounting and days at sea charging. NIMS routinely returns to port those vessels miscoded for the area fished or with VMS units that have stopped reporting. Now, once a declaration is sent from the pier, the fishermen will receive an acknowledgement from their VMS vendor. Again, that acknowledgement comes from the vendor, not from NIMS. The acknowledgement reflects both the VMS code and a brief description of that code. Now, while the Northeast regulations don't require you to wait for your acknowledgement, OLE recommends that you do so to ensure the message is received by the satellite provider and sent on to NIMS. It's also a good check to ensure the declaration accurately reflects your intended activity. Again, I want to emphasize the acknowledgement comes from the vendor. So it's not permission per se from NIMS to go fishing. It's simply an acknowledgement from the vendor that the code's been received and forwarded on to NIMS. When a declaration is sent, it's received by our monitoring system in a code format. This is an example of a multi-species code, NMS, MUL, OPA, DSX, and you can see how that code is broken down. NMS is the species code or Northeast multi-species. MUL is the plan code, multi-species regular access. OP is the area ID, open area. A days, gear type, day gill net. S being the trip modifier, in this case, the Southern New England differential area. And then the X is a placeholder for future expansion if we need to. The codes have gotten more and more complex. As you can see in the bottom of this slide, about a year and a half ago, we had 52 codes. Now we've got 230. This reflects both the increased complexity in VMS reporting, but also the additional flexibility. By the way, these codes, and again, there are 230 of them, you can find them in their definition on the Northeast website under the fishing industry homepage. Go to the VMS regulations. There's a lot of information there regarding Northeast VMS. This is what a trip looks like in our monitoring system. It's called SmartTrack. This is the system that the VMS team monitors to watch for compliance. A trip is generated when a vessel crosses the VMS demarcation line, and that line is the solid dark blue line with the shaded part shoreward of the line. You can see it there around the Cape Cod and also around Nantucket Island. The trip starts on the first position report received seaward of the demarcation line. So the trip does not start exactly at the demarc line, but the first position report your VMS unit sends us. In this particular case, the trip started at 11:36 Greenwich on February 21st. And this particular vessel is on half-hourly reporting. You can see the position reports there showing the date and the time. Again, our system records everything in Greenwich or Zulu time. Anytime the vessel's VMS unit fails to send the required position reports, The length of the trip, and consequently the days at sea charge, if any, can be adversely affected. Hence, the importance for fishermen to ensure their VMS units are fully operational and are reporting normally. If you ever have any questions about, the accurate accounting of your trip, give the VMS team a call. All this information is recorded by our system. We can go back 10 years. We can go back to the beginning of time with VMS and look at a trip. Again, the VMS code declared drives the days at sea charge for the trip, if any. It is not required, nor is it authorized, for vessels to change their declaration or clock out once they cross the demarcation line on the return to port with product on board. Again, the trip will stop when the vessel crosses the demarcation line. In this example, the trip ended at 2350 Greenwich on February 22nd. That would be the first position report shoreward of the demarcation line. Completed VMS trips are loaded to the Northeast Region's Days at Sea database. That database is not maintained by OLE. It's maintained by the region. The appropriate days at sea charging is performed within this database. Our monitoring system simply collects the trips, and those trips get downloaded nightly to the days at sea database where the appropriate days at sea charging is performed. OLE does currently provide days at sea balance information by telephone. However, the information may not be available in real time due to the processing that must be performed between the VMS and days at sea databases. Now, in order to assist fishermen with the tracking of their days at sea, the regional office has an initiative to implement a days at sea webpage. The prototype would be sometime this fall. And that webpage would provide a personalized accounting of vessels' trips. And OLE supports that webpage. We think that's a very good idea to help industry track their days at sea more closely. By the way, a point worth noting here for trip generation, because trips are only generated when a vessel crosses the demarcation line, if you fish totally inside the demarc line or you fish in and out of the line on the same trip, it's important that you use the interactive voice response call-in system to record your days at sea trip rather than VMS. In other words, you would call IVR before leaving the dock. It's the IVR system that would record that days at sea trip and be captured in the days at sea database. You still have to have the VMS unit on and reporting, and you would put a DOF or declare out a fishery code into your VMS unit. This is an example of one of the trip forms I mentioned earlier, the differential area layover form. It's a good one to send for safety purposes if you need to move inshore because of inclement weather. You would send that form if you need to lay over in either the Gulf of Maine or southern New England area. This is an easy form to send. You just go to that form on your VMS unit, read it, confirm that it fits your situation, hit send. A copy of that form will be saved in your message outbox. If an agent ever questions you about it, you have proof that it was sent in your VMS unit. With regard to power downs and when they're authorized, all VMS-equipped vessels can apply to OLE for a letter of exemption if they intend to be hauled out for a minimum of 72 hours. Multi-species permitted vessels can apply for the letter of exemption if they don't intend to fish or move the vessel from its dock or mooring for at least 30 days. The letter of exemption, by the way, is a form available on the NERO website, or you can contact the VMS team. The form is either mailed or faxed to us. It must be received with enough lead time to allow us to respond and for you to have it in your hand before you turn off the VMS. The general category scallop fleet may also power down their VMS, but they have to send a power down declaration code before they do so. Once the acknowledgement is received, the power to the VMS unit can then be disconnected. This code is valid only at the dock or mooring, and before moving the vessel, another declaration must be sent, as vessels are never authorized to sail on a power down declaration code. And finally, herring vessels, they can turn their power off to the unit when they're in port. And there is a caveat there that if you hold other permits that require continuous reporting, then you can't take advantage of that general category power down declaration or, you know, turn your unit off in port. Following the recent announcement by NIMS requiring all vessels to declare every trip, industry responded with their concerns, which included the increased costs they would incur declaring every time they sail. This slide shows the cost associated with sending a declaration as provided to us by two of the vendors, SkyMate and Botrax. The declaration costs are much higher for Botrax vessels than they are for SkyMate. A declaration and an acknowledgement from a SkyMate vessel runs between 12 and 17 cents each. For SkyMate vessels, there's no cost for an acknowledgement. When you send a declaration, the satellite provider sets up a three-way link between your unit, the satellite, and the ground station. The declaration is sent, and then when the link comes down, the acknowledgement shows up in your code log. Botrax, for a declaration and an acknowledgement, depending on whether it's an acceptance or a rejection of your code, runs between $1.55 and $2.40 to do that transaction. Next. Who pays for messaging? Industry is required to pay the cost of monthly airtime for their VMS units and the messages that they originate from their VMS units, including the automatic position reports, half-hourly or hourly, depending on the permit that you hold. If you hold a general category 1B or limited access scallop permit, you're on 30-minute reporting, regardless of your activity. Everybody else is on hourly reporting. NIMS pays the cost associated with all messages which NIMS sends to the vessels. NIMS also pays the cost of any additional polling to execute its enforcement mission. And we can change the vessel's reporting rate to as often as every 5 minutes. Another industry concern was the time it took to receive a declaration acknowledgement. NIMS asked two of the vendors to run a three-month report. Here's the data from January to March for Botrax and SkyMate. About 92% of Botrax declarations were acknowledged within 10 minutes, and about 82% for SkyMate declarations. Less than 2% of Botrax vessels had a delayed acknowledgement greater than 30 minutes, with over 5% of SkyMate vessels taking longer than 30 minutes. If a fisherman canceled a declaration before it was sent, for example, if they were waiting a long period of time for an acknowledgement, SkyMate users sometimes get a message pending. If they don't have good satellite connectivity, those statistics would not be captured in this report. This is probably the heart of my brief on the capabilities limitations. Capabilities limitations may be a bit of a misnomer because some of these limitations are really driven by the accuracy of the data reported through the VMS unit from the fishermen, and sometimes there's latency concerns from the network itself. But let me start off by saying that I think that VMS is most effective as an enforcement tool for closed area and access area monitoring. And we're talking about automatic position reports. That's what it does well. That's its bread and butter. But also other automated data delivery methods, such as point-and-click VMS forms, remove the inaccuracies caused by the manual entry of data. Of course, this assumes the VMS unit is fully operational at all times. For monitoring purposes, VMS data transmitted from vessels is received by NIMS in near real time, and all historical data can be easily retrieved and viewed to determine if a violation occurred and to document cases. And by the way, the Coast Guard First District in Boston receives a VMS feed from us, and they also have our Smart Track monitoring system in their command center. So they have that tool as an additional resource to them. Additionally, the NIMS monitoring system can provide automatic alerting to enforcement staff if a vessel, for example, enters a closed area. Enhanced VMS units required in the Northeast allow for near real-time communications between NIMS and the fishermen. This is typically used to communicate directly to a single vessel, such as for enforcement actions, or to broadcast time-sensitive information to the fleet, such as for the closure of an access area, the elephant trunk being a recent example for the general category fleet. When regulations change and require VMS software updates, Botrax and Tron and Tron have the ability to transmit VMS software changes over the air. They can do that very quickly and efficiently. However, SkyMate must typically mail out their changes via CD, requiring the fishermen to manually load the new software. Now, this often results in compliance problems, requiring NIMS to remind owners to run the latest software in order to remain fully VMS compliant. With regard to safety, while some VMS units have either an included or optional safety feature, such as a distress or panic button, the VMS is not a substitute for a vessel's EPIRB or radio. NIMS never intended VMS to be used as a safety system. Rather, it was designed as an enforcement tool. While the NIMS agents have the ability to check on a VMS vessel at any time, VMS is not routinely monitored on a 24/7 basis, making its use as a safety system very limited. As I mentioned, the Coast Guard has the ability to use the VMS data to assist them in SAR planning and for forensic data after an event has been reported. As a management tool, such as for days at sea reporting, I think that the greater manual entry of data required of the fishermen, the higher the potential for inaccuracy. No real surprise there. NIMS sees a higher than desired error rate with the more data intensive forms, such as the catch reports, which can impact area attack monitoring. Frequent regulatory changes requiring VMS software changes can lead to confusion among fishermen if declaration screens and VMS forms are continually changing and becoming more complex. As an example, with the multi-species declaration screen on the Botrax unit, the vendor had to split it up among two screens because that the declaration screen has gotten so lengthy with all the flexing options that are now authorized. With regard to the network, the satellite network, the VMS system relies on a complex network of providers and satellite technology that must work in sync in order for positions, declarations, catch, and trip forms to be sent, received, and processed properly. While a management program like Days at Sea relies heavily on data accuracy, timeliness, and the orderliness of the data that's being received, there are occasional delays in data delivery or latency in a satellite-based system that can cause trip anomalies. An example might be declarations that come in out of order. We might see a power-down declaration that comes in after a scallop declaration and a trip opens on a power-down code. That's happened in a few occasions. It doesn't happen very often, but it does happen. Now, these kinds of trips are analyzed by the VMS team through trip monitoring or at the request of a fisherman, and appropriate database mods are performed. So we can reach into the Days at Sea database, and we can make the changes. Some of you have probably talked to Bethany or Patty and done that. With regard to software, again, that can be problematic. For SkyMate, remember that the current software is version 3.86. There are also significant costs associated with making VMS software changes to meet regulatory changes. For example, for Framework 42, last November, the changes cost approximately $70,000. And that was just to have the three vendors make the changes to the software. That doesn't include the changes that the SmartTrack VMS contractor had to do as well. Additionally, the monthly messaging costs paid for by NIMS currently range between $25,000 and $35,000 per month. And that's a 200% increase in the last 2 years. as the fleet gets greater, the costs are only going to get higher. And finally, on that last line there, self-installs, the Northeast region doesn't prohibit self-installations, which are more likely to result in equipment problems than those that are done by a professional installer. With regard to missing position reports, I think that, and I don't want to speak for Rodney, but I think he may cover a little bit of this in his enforcement report. John Pinkerton, the national VMS manager from Silver Spring, was here yesterday to speak to the VMS Enforcement Committee and gave some data on missing position reports. This is a request from the council to NIMS, specifically a report on VMS polling showing the number and length of missing position reports for each vendor. So I'd like to address that a little bit. First of all, I'm going to assume that the council meant missing position reports in terms of reports that we never receive, that OLE never receives, as opposed to delayed reports. In other words, reports that are sent but are delayed in their delivery, but we eventually receive. Satellite network problems can result in the loss of position reports. However, these types of outages are very rare. We're talking, again, about the satellite network. The Orbcoms for SkyMate, Qualcomm for boat tracks, et cetera. These are rare. When they do occur, the satellite provider notifies NIMS in advance for any planned work that may impact data delivery or after an unplanned event has occurred. The most common scenario I've observed is with Qualcomm, when they switch between their ground facilities, which requires a brief hour or so of shutdown of their service. This scenario would affect boat tracks vessels only. Missing position reports are more likely the result of any one of a variety of vessel equipment problems. These situations are evaluated and responded to on an individual basis. Examples of those situations that may cause missing position reports include when their external power outages, and the internal battery doesn't function properly or runs down its charge, damaged antennas or poorly located antennas that result in a blockage or EMI, bad connections, saltwater intrusion, transceiver failures, which are typically rare, and excessive ice buildup could also impact it. There is also something called globograms. Our monitoring system receives but filters out any position reports that are sent by a process known as globogram. This affects SkyMate users. In my experience, position reports sent by globogram occur very infrequently, a very small number, but I thought it was worth mentioning here. Probably no more than a few percent of all positional data we receive. The globograms are generated when communications between the vessel and the satellite provider, in this case Orbcom, cannot be established using normal service areas and methods. As a result, these position reports are always delayed, and processing them could impact how trips are generated and how days at sea are charged. We are looking at ways to process and display globogram positions in our monitoring system while filtering them from the trip generation or days at sea accounting side. And finally, some of the points of contact for the VMS team. You see that at the top of the slide, myself, Linda, Bethany, Patty. If you have days at sea questions about your balances, Bethany and Patty are the people to talk to. Any one of us can answer any VMS questions. If we're unsure about some of the regulatory questions, we'll refer you to SFD. Our phone numbers are up there. The main phone number to the office in OLE is up there, 978-281-9213, as well as our fax number. I mentioned the region's website, and you'll find the VMS requirements under the fishing industry homepage. I did write some VMS user instructions. It's lengthy, more than 20 pages, but I think it's laid out so that you can refer to the section that you might have questions about. For instance, what do I need to do when I'm at the dock or the mooring? What happens when I cross the demarcation line, headed out to sea? what happens when I'm returning the port? How do I contact a duty agent? When should I contact the VMS support center at Silver Spring? All these kinds of things are addressed in those user instructions, as well as a little bit of information on the reimbursement program as well. And there's also at the bottom there the general mailbox. You'll see nymphs.ole.ne@noaa.gov. You can always send an email to that mailbox from your internet address or from your VMS unit. We check that daily. And that concludes my brief. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Bill. Questions for Bill? Dr. Pierce.
You mentioned, of course, that there's 24-hour, 7-day coverage, VMS coverage. However, it's not checked all the time. What's the protocol for checking the VMS information that comes in? For example, every 6 hours or so, do you take a look at VMS reports to determine where the vessels are relative to a particular closed area, for example? So what protocol do you follow?
Sure. Okay. We have a small team, as I showed on the slide there. We do VMS monitoring every day, every work day. Let me clarify that. That is our primary task. We certainly have other collateral duties, but the team knows that they're going to be monitoring VMS every day, not only the VMS team, but also the NIPS agents throughout the Northeast region have access in the field to VMS. How we go about doing that, I'm not going to say. I'm not going to address specifically how we do that, but I can tell you that every day we're looking at the fleet, and we have certain priorities in terms of closed areas or the scallop access areas, Nantucket Lightship, closed area one that opened up last Friday. They do a thorough job of looking at throughout the fleet. But the other thing, too, is after a weekend, they'll go back and they'll look at the previous weekend trips and, you know, look for potential violations there, pass those on. The, as far as 24/7 coverage, that's above me. If NIMS will ever go to that, we do the best we can with the resources that we have and the requirements that have been placed on us.
Okay, you just said that NIMS law enforcement agents have access to the VMS information, of course. I assume that the state law enforcement officers would also have access to the VMS information.
They will. They will, right. Right now, do they have access to our smart track monitoring system in their offices? No. And what are they going to have in the future? I can't speak to. That's a decision at Silver Spring. But they will have access to it. It may either be in their office through remote access, or it may be through a shared arrangement with a NIMS agent in the field.
Okay, so let me give you a specific example. Let's say that a sea herring vessel is out fishing and then it's coming back ashore. It has a specific reporting procedure. I think it's 6 hours before they come back, they have to notify. How would I know when they're coming back to shore? I wouldn't know right now, correct? Because I don't have access to VMS information. The state representative from the Division of Marine Fisheries, I don't have access. No one in our agency has access, I don't think. So I couldn't call your office and find out where the vessel is, when it's coming back in, or could I?
Yes, you can.
Okay, I can. So I can call you, or our law enforcement officers could call you, and therefore we could be at the dock to check the boat when it comes in for whatever purposes we may have.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. We are currently providing VMS information to state agents.
Okay. But okay. A related question. The information itself. Well, let me again another example. Let's say that I wanted to get a record, a VMS record of a subset of vessels that are in some particular fishery to see where they're fishing relative to the boundary of a particular closed area. Would I be able to get that access? In other words, written information, plots, or...
Are we talking a state agent?
State agency, right.
Yes.
It wouldn't have to be the law enforcement agency. It could be the management agency, correct?
It would have to be law enforcement.
It would have to be law enforcement.
Can I
certainly.
Can I feel this? Is that okay, Mr. Chairman? Thanks. Under the Reauthorized Magnuson Act, the state will have access to VMS data. Currently, we're being very conservative, and what we have about a year from now to develop a policy and a protocol for sharing that information. Before we do, there's going to have to be some training and confidentiality. There are going to have to be waivers signed, confidentiality agreements, and the actual VMS SmartTracks data will be very limited. It's not realistic to think that every laptop and every patrol car of every JEA partner will have access. Currently, if a state law enforcement agency, fisheries law enforcement agency, needs the information, all they need to do is call Bill's office, and that will be provided. For a fisheries management purpose or for any other government purpose, we're currently still requiring a court order or a subpoena to do that. So in the scenario that you just laid out, we currently can't give you that information right like that on the telephone. In about a year, we'll be able to once everything's put in place.
Okay, thank you very much. That answers my questions.
John Nelson.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Bill, that was a very nice overview. I'd like to go back to one of your slides, and that was the response time. If you can go back to that. Yeah, that one there. Now, I guess this is an overall time or an average, I guess. What we were hearing in the council is that earlier this year there was a lot of problems with the response time, that they seemed to be excessively, and then when folks called up to get their information or whatever, they were not able to get that. Could you just elaborate a little bit on whether or not you saw that as a problem and what steps you guys took to address it if you did find it was a problem?
I'd be happy to. I think that the response times for acknowledgments have mainly been an issue for SkyMay users. And if there's somebody here that has had a problem with BoatTrax, I'd certainly like to hear it. But it happens much less frequently with BoatTrax. SkyMay has, their representatives were here yesterday at the VMS Enforcement Committee meeting. And they spoke to that a little bit. They, because we asked them specifically why is it that some owners are experiencing an hour or 2 hour or longer delays in getting their acknowledgments? That as they're reporting, SkyMate's reporting, it's 2.5%. But if you're one of those 2.5%, you're concerned. Their reply has been that about two-thirds of those owners in the 2.5%, it's a small number of owners, the problem was traced to the equipment on the vessel. A third was traced to the network, the latency that I mentioned earlier. Does that answer it?
Do you, are you finding that these numbers are not reflective now of what is happening out there? Again, I'm assuming you took this over a period of time and it's some type of average. Do you find that 1% of boat track folks, almost 1%, are waiting over an hour to get a response now, or do you find that that has improved?
Well, the way we're going to know is when an owner calls us and expresses their dissatisfaction. What I, in my experience in the last 2 years, BoatTrax, actually, we're talking BoatTrax and Qualcomm, it's been quite reliable. I have test units in the office. I have a Tron, BoatTrax, SkyMate, and a Freya, and they're live units. They report to our SmartTrax system. I've had good experience, but then again, I'm a building and not a vessel. So things can be a little bit different in the maritime environment. But, yeah, I've certainly seen a difference between the two vendors. I've seen a much better reliability in getting acknowledgement on the BoTrac side than I have on the SkyMate side.
And just one last question, Mr. Chairman, and that is there was concern, I think, expressed by law enforcement earlier in the year or late last year about the volume of declarations that would be coming into the system because of what we were looking at is needing to have tracked, vessels tracked, and so on. Are you able, do you feel you're handling the increased volume and will be able to handle additional if we so desire to have additional declarations come into you? What's your capacity?
Do you mean just sheer number, or do you mean the increased number of VMS codes? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, why don't we just go for sheer numbers first?
Well, I think that as I showed in that last slide, you know, we're a small team. Can we use additional resources to be more efficient in the way we do our job? Most definitely. But to answer more your question more directly, increasing the number of declarations, yeah, we can still do it. The system can handle it. The SmartTrack system is, you know, to think that that system is capturing trips from the beginning of time for VMS, there's a lot of data there. And right now, it can handle it without a problem. And we're able to handle it.
Anyone else? Paul Howard, then David.
Bill, you mentioned Tron and Tron a couple times. Are they accepted now, and do you have response rates for them? And what percent of the required VMS users use BoTrac compared to SkyMate and others?
All right, Paul. Can we go back to that second slide? All the way back. You can see the number of Tron vessels on the far right there. There's only 28 currently in the Northeast. Tron is a new entry into the Northeast. They were approved back in May of 06, so about a year. They are a very large company. I think they've got tens of thousands of users globally, but within the Northeast, a very small number currently. As far as declaration response times, Paul, I don't have that yet. Again, my experience has been, again, I've got a Tron unit in the office. Comes back within a matter of a few minutes. It's been pretty reliable. But if we hear problems out in the fleet, that's where we start to address them. We're very interested in industry's experience with all these units. There's a very active work order program within OLE. We document problems, forward them up to Silver Spring, so they are documented. And they go out to the appropriate vendors for review and comment.
Okay. I wanted to thank you, Bill. You get a lot of information here that I've been principally trying to request. I would make one statement, and that is to whoever, I know it's not to you, but to the higher-ups, that we need a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week contact person, a real person for these, whatever it is, 5% or whatever, that are failures. And you know, waiting an hour or 2 hours for a declaration to go through, I classify as a failure. And it has to be some way to sail and to fish when those occur. I did have a couple of questions as well. This issue of ice, that kind of has vindicated something I was saying. What is that resulting in? Is it resulting in a permanent outage until the ice is removed? Have they studied it at all? Could we get more information on that? Because that's going to be a real problem in the winter months.
Yeah, Dave, I'll have to research that for you. I before this presentation, I asked the vendors for some of the common reasons for missed position reports. Tron, Charlie Natoli, I believe you might have met, he's been to the committee meeting before, mentioned that. But, you know, what kind of detail he's referring to, I'll have to gather that and I can get back to you.
Okay, that would be very helpful. The other issue was, now, you know, I had one declaration and took an hour and 17 minutes, which we researched extensively together. And I think their last communication was that it may be a radio signal interference from either the Navy base or the air base up in New Hampshire, because they can't find anything else that it could be. And I have to say, in all honesty, I've been fishing out of Gloucester since June 1st. My acknowledgments are going through in 3 to 5 minutes as opposed to 30 minutes to an hour up off of Hampton, New Hampshire. So that may be something you want to look at. You know, I don't know what they generate over there at the Navy base for sub-signals or whatever, but there may be something going on that's following this up. I mean, that may be a legitimate answer. It may not be another excuse that I thought I was hearing from the vendor. And the last question I'd ask is I think John Nelson tried to get at it as well, is a sense of where do we go from here? This system has clearly suffered a lot of growing pains. It's getting better, but it's still got, in my opinion, a long ways to go. And do we at this time want to add any further burdens to it? Or I mean, you know, do you think it can handle further burdens? Or do you think that we ought to just wait a while, fix it, you know, get it going as good as we can before we burden it with more codes, more boats, more whatever?
My opinion, I think that you might want to take a little slower approach. And I think the reason I say that is, as I mentioned in one of the slides, I don't know if you caught it, but, you know, latency in delivery of the data can cause some problems in the way the trips are generated in a system. Now, we can accommodate that by delaying when we capture those trips. And I won't go into all the detail there. But by doing that, we're not maybe responding to you as soon as you would like, when you start a trip, when you end a trip. Right now, there's a couple-hour delay, as you know, in getting your trip start and end email. And we do that to account for the latency in a network. We have a two-hour delay. You cross the VMS line, start a trip, the system waits 2 hours before it actually starts the trip, collects the position reports, orders them, and opens it on a proper position report. Then you get your trip start email. I would rather you get it right away, but we're trying to accommodate, you know, the existing system. And we can accommodate that. But at what point do you're not going to accommodate industry necessarily. You've got to find that happy medium.
Okay, thank you for your candor. It's appreciated. And just another note, I haven't got a landing or confirmation from either Saturday or Sunday as of when I left my house this morning, so I don't know if something's wrong again or what. But up until last Friday, we were getting things just like you said, about 2 hours and 6 hours on the other end. So they were always there the next morning, and you had some sense that things were going well. But I don't know. We're on the fritz again now after the weekend.
Let me talk to that a little bit. Again, in my experience, I've seen delays in the delivery of data from the satellite provider through our servers at Silver Spring to Gloucester. Data stalls, I'll call them. When data stalls, we've built into the system a trip so that the trip accounting, trip or a circuit breaker, if you will, think of it that way, so that the trips in our system are not generated badly, because delayed positional data only exacerbates the latency problem. So we put a fuse in there to stop the trip accounting in our system. When we do that, any trip start or end email stop. Again, you know, we're trying to find that happy medium there. We want to make sure the trips are generated properly because they're getting fed to the Days at Sea database and the charging is being done there. But you're not going to get the trip start and end emails until somebody manually looks at the trip feed coming from the vendors, whoever the offending vendor is, gets that data caught up in our system, and then turns the trip generation script back on. Then the trip start and end emails will flow again, and that you might be seeing some of that. For everybody here, too, in our database, some of you know it, some of you don't, not only do we have the email address of the VMS unit, and that's where your trip start and end email goes, but we can also put a secondary email address in there, too, your internet address. And those trip start and end emails can go to that address as well. And a lot of you have taken advantage of it. Others may want to. But that was a description of how those trip start and end emails sometimes aren't making it out there in a timely way. In the SkyMate Orbcom world, we've been dealing with an email delivery system and servers that have been prone to stalling. And that's been a real headache that I've seen in the 2 years I've here. And I've worked with headquarters to get that changed, to have them understand the problems that the Northeast region has related to the email delivery through these servers. And they've listened to me. They're making a change which should go into effect any day now, which would eliminate the email infrastructure and go to what's called an IP gateway, where the data would be sitting there from Orbcom, NIMS comes up and pulls it down, and it's a much better handshake of data. It eliminates any stalling that might be going on internal to NOAA fisheries. I think it's going to improve the latency, although it probably won't eliminate it, because in the Orbcom system itself, it's not a geosynchronous, it's a low Earth orbit satellite system, so the satellite's not always in view of the gateway. So there's going to be some inherent latency there. But I think the IP gateway will improve the delivery of the data. It's a positive thing.
Okay. Ronnie, you have other motions, don't you? How many?
We got 7 action items from the last meeting that we didn't take care of because there was no report, and 6 for this one.
All right. Phil, do you mind if we move on with other items, or do you have a burning question?
One, I got to put something on the record. Not that anybody can read it, but I got to put it on there anyhow. And two, to Paul's question real quick, I talked to a fellow from Thronodron, and I think everybody needs to be aware. They're the company. They handle the HMS systems for that fishery. They also handle the Western, the Hawaiian Island fishery. They're the companies that's handling those fisheries. The other one, I can wait until the end of the report if you want.
Rodney, you ready?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Bill. That was an excellent presentation. Outstanding, as always. We have, last council meeting, we didn't give you a report because we had a failure. We're just going to bring you up to date on that. The first action item was... Previous committee meeting, we had a request for an outages report, and we got that yesterday. It was a presentation by John Pinkerton, and it showed, as Bill had said, that it was not as we first thought it was. It was a lot of outages. The outage percentage was very small, so that report was delivered to the committee yesterday. The second one was the committee recommended that the scallop committee that landings and declaration issue be addressed to be consistent with multi-species regulation, other fisheries regulations, and landings be in a 24-hour period. The committee had some safety concerns on that. That was a motion from the committee to the council that was approved. Since our last meeting, the scallop committee meeting has dealt with that and addressed that. The next one, the committee recommended that the council request the Office of Law Enforcement to draft a list of concerns and recommendations to establish a protocol for safe harbor. This motion was approved by a roll call vote, 3 yeses, 3 abstentions. The next one, the committee recommended that the council ask National Marine Fisheries Service to develop an updated and more friendly VMS system, with consideration given to addressing issues that would allow easy easing regulations and an inconsistent or duplicative. And that would allow reporting requirements to increase industry flexibility. This motion was approved. 3 yeses and zero no votes. 3 abstentions.
Rodney.
Yes.
Sorry to interrupt you. I think what we'll do is take it issue by issue, unless you were,
okay.
You were proposing to just introduce them all in one big motion.
Pardon me?
Were you going to introduce
them? Well,
I was
just going to go through them, and then, you know, this was the last committee meeting.
Right.
Do you want to go one by one?
Some of these require the council to take
right.
action, so we're going to need to have a motion.
Right. I was going to go through them all and go back, unless you want to go one by one. You want to go one by one, that's fine.
I think we should pick them off as we go down
okay.
the line.
Okay. The first one wasn't a motion. That was just a request, and that's been dealt with. The second one was the committee motion, and that was approved. That was dealt with in the
safe harbor issue, has that been dealt with?
That's the third one now. We just made the committee made a motion that the council request Lauren to go. That hasn't been done yet.
Okay, any discussion on this motion from the committee?
Mr. Chairman, number one under tab 12 is Andy Cohen's already taken action on that, so there's no need for a motion, and his response to that is in number one under tab 12.
All right, well, I'm getting mixed up. These are motions from the previous meeting. Okay. Okay, so we don't need to take action on this, right?
Because we had no report at the previous meeting. I was just trying to catch us up to that.
Okay.
Okay. So you want to skip those? I was just bringing up the council up to date.
Right. No, we didn't have an enforcement report at the last meeting
right.
because we didn't have the motions
right.
available for the council to review.
So.
Are you able to go through the motions that were made at the last meeting?
The motions?
Yeah.
Okay.
Ones that haven't been dealt with.
They have been dealt with. So you want to skip the ones that have been dealt with?
Yes. I just want to do the ones that still require action from the
okay.
council.
We have a committee motion that recommends the council request National Marine Fisheries to establish a declaration that would allow vessels to transit into closed areas without minimal gear storage requirements. Do we have that up there?
Okay, and that was a committee motion?
Yes.
Okay.
That was a committee motion. The motion was approved. 2 yeses and 1 no vote and 3 abstentions.
Any discussion from the council on the committee motion? David Pierce.
Yeah, what prompted the committee to make the motion? What's the concern? Is there something new that we haven't remitted?
Well, it was brought up by one committee member that it was still some of the practice was unsafe, and he felt like where we had VMS that we could be able to transit areas without the storage of putting somebody up to top up a net drum or to disconnect the tow cables from the wires, from the doors. And that's what prompted that motion.
Phil Roll.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd be the prompter. And the reason this came up was just, as Rodney was saying, that some of the requirements that are in right now for transit in a closed area, you have to top off the net, you have to remove the tripper, you have to disconnect the doors. the wires. All of these storage requirements have to be met, which is very impractical and pretty silly. In the wintertime, when you're out there trying to hold a 20-foot tarp in a gale of wind and wrap it around a net drum so you can get home safely, it's really just makes no sense. They were put in effect before VMS was mandated in this fishery. Now any boat out there has to have VMS, and what I was looking for is a declaration. You're going to go across the closed area. You notify NIMS you're going across it. They can pull you every few minutes. I don't care. You know, once you hit a closed area, your pulling rate goes to I think it's 5 minutes anyhow. So while you're in there, they're going to be watching you every 5 minutes, and this would here just alleviate as much safety concerns.
Thanks, Bill. Anyone wish to speak against this? Anyone still want more clarity? Okay, I'm going to call the question. All those in favor, please raise your hand. Eleven. Opposed? Danny, you can't vote twice. Anyone opposed? One. Abstentions? One, two. Okay, the motion carries 11-1. Two abstentions. What's next, Rodney?
I think that's it for that one, right, Lou? Okay. That was it for that one.
So now we're on to
yesterday's meeting.
Okay. There was a motion just before that. It was kind of a general motion to encourage NIMS to update and provide a more user-friendly VMS system. That was a motion from the April meeting. Whether you want to take it up now or not, I guess it's up to you. But it was a motion that was approved at the April committee meeting.
Can I get a little background on this? I understand some of it, but...
Yeah, I think some of it was clarified through the presentation. It was that a lot of the industry didn't know how to use the macros in the background and to develop a protocol. I think that's what it was about, right, Phil?
So, go ahead, Phil.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll try and be quick. The reason this came out is when you go back and look at where we are and where we were, a lot of the regulations that we now have on the books are written, just like I mentioned before, prior to VMS. And a lot of the regulations, a lot of issues can be dealt with in the VMS that are not being dealt with at this present time because VMS wasn't there when we wrote the regulations. So we need to go back and take a real good look at where everything is. And can you answer some of these questions with VMS? And can we provide some flexibility or not, you know, maybe whichever way it goes, but some of these issues need to be brought forward and looked at in one sense. Rodney's right. It was also you have a pretty, as you just seen in this presentation, you're now up to 230 codes, three different machines on how to do it and what have you. I think futuristically looking for VMS to go forward, we need to come back to some kind of or go to some kind of machine or much more user-friendly system that's going to accommodate what VMS needs to do in the future. It doesn't. Right now, it's an enforcement tool. It's an analogy is an ankle bracelet, and that's all they want it to be. I think we have to get away from that. I'm looking to make the system work for both people involved. Enforcement has their needs with it, and there should be some plenty of thought given to what the industry can get out of this machine at the same time. And that's what the concept of the motion is, I think.
Yeah, I'll just suggest I think this motion might be a little premature. The enforcement committee would be helpful if they could spend some time on this and maybe provide some examples, concrete examples of the types of issues that you intended to be addressed in this, other than, you know, as opposed to just handing it to the service and saying, go through all the regulations and determine which ones may be obsolete because we now have VMS. And I agree that VMS could probably obviate some of them, but I think that probably coming from the committee back to the council and up would be the best course. So
we seem to have an angle axle problem with that approach, John, to be honest with you. I mean, we started to try to go down that way and develop that, and in my mind, whenever we try to attack a problem, we're basically told that the regulations don't allow us to. So we really need to define where these regulations, in my mind, we need to define where the regulation problems are. So, I mean, just to go back to where we were a minute ago with the Andy's letter on the safe harbor issue. Well, if you read that, they're not really against a safe harbor policy or providing some kind of safety valve that lets a boat come in. But the regulations don't allow that. So the OLE has to say we can't do that because the regulations don't allow that. If you come in, you got an overage, we got to take the fish. That's what the regulation says. We need to go back and look at all of these plans and say, how the hell can we do this? You know, I mean, you got in the regulations now, right across the board, whether it's Mid-Atlantic or New England, we have possession limits that drive, stop this bus before it can make the turn, is really what happens. You can't get there. So I don't totally disagree that we need to go that way, but I also want to remind the council, I think we got two more meetings left. That one or two is a poll.
Pat, do you have anything to add to this if we draft a letter and send it to you requesting this?
What we're going to say is that the regulations don't allow us to do that. So, I mean, it is circular. The fact of the matter is the VMS requirements reflect the regulations that were adopted through the management actions that the council took. And so if you want to change the VMS requirements, and I completely agree that they're too complex, and it may be a worthwhile effort to see if there's some way to streamline them or make them less complex or get somehow away from all of the codes and the declarations that we have. But those are regulatory changes that are within the purview of the council, and so it's the council that needs to talk about it.
Who else in the council? John Nelson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think your approach was the right approach. If the committee is going to have time, budget-wise, then perhaps that's the charge to them. I don't think they need to necessarily be put off or have the circle of you can't do it because, you know, that what the committee would look at is, and I hope with the assistance of the VMS folks in Gloucester, to say, well, what can we modify to now that VMS is up and running, and what would we look for modifications of regulations or whatever it is? And they would come back and make a recommendation to the council for consideration, and then we deal with it accordingly. I don't think they have to be put off by it's a regulation and therefore we can't do anything about it. They're merely making a recommendation to us based on a review of the overall, in this case, reporting system and how it might be modified, and we can then suggest a modification to the regulations if that's what we want to do.
Rodney.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. That clarified things, because every time we started to go down this road, we were told that it's going to be a committee action or a council action. So maybe what we'll do, we'll put this on the next agenda. We'll make it a top priority. We'll go over it with enforcement and VMS committee. I mean, the VMS users, and maybe we can identify some of these problems and start that right away. Thank you.
I think that's a good course to go. I'm hearing from all sides that things are too complex right now, so put all the heads together, and hopefully you'll be back at the next meeting with some good recommendations. Phil?
Just for clarification, should that be added to the terms of reference for the committee? I don't think that was clear in that one.
Yeah, I want to make it clear. I think that the name of the committee is VMS Enforcement and Safety Committee. We keep calling it enforcement, but that's the official name of it. And the reason why the committee is meeting is because you were instrumental in getting us I think, $15,000 or $16,000 to address VMS, to make it most effective to meet our needs. So that's why we're meeting, is because we have money to look at making a more effective VMS system. So it's perfectly within the scope to have, I think we can have a couple more meetings, and then when we look at priorities, we're going to have to see, we're going to have to see if we have funding to continue it next year, you know, without additional funds or with additional funds.
Okay, Rodney.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now we go on to yesterday's meeting. The minutes from the April meeting were approved 4-0. The next action item was there was a recommendation to have a letter drafted offering to provide input to Congress on upcoming safety legislation if they needed it. That was not a motion. That was just a recommendation if they needed it. The next one will be a motion. It was a motion from that the committee recommend the council to the council that National Marine Fisheries examine the requirement to only change fishing codes from inside the demarcation line on a fishery requirement VMS, heron, scallop, i.e. heron, scallop, general category, limited access, multi-species. That motion was approved. 2 in favor, 0 against, and 3 abstentions.
Okay, a little more background on this one.
Okay, that was that only to change that code inside the demarcation line for when let me get this straight now. The vessels will That was yours. Yeah,
Mike.
That's right. They were required to come back in to change the code if they had a wrong code outside the demarcation line. That was what that one was about.
So this motion would allow vessels, request that vessels are allowed to change their code
if they remained in the same fishery. Not to change fisheries outside. If they were in the same fishery and they had a problem with their acknowledgement, the way it is now, they would have to come inside of the demarcation line to correct that.
Now, I'm familiar with that. I've experienced that before. All right. Any discussion? John Nelson?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I don't know if this needs to be done on a very timely basis, and if it does, then obviously we should move ahead. But I would suggest that this is an example of what we just talked about as far as taking a look at the overall VMS system and what overall might be modified to address various issues. And this seems to fit exactly into that category. Now, if this can wait and be done with a suite of other measures, that's what I would suggest we do so that you're not piecemealing the VMS. And that way you have an opportunity to look and have an overview of what you have done versus saying, here's a little piece here and a little piece there. So unless there's a real immediacy to deal with this, and I'm sure somebody would have that immediacy, but my sense is that it should be one of the components of the what we just requested the committee to take a look at.
Bill.
I don't totally disagree, but there is a couple of issues to come up, and I'd just like to say where they are. One of the things driving this is, if you notice, it's not to change them, it's to request NIMS to examine whether they really should be in there in each fishery, in a fishery-by-fishery type basis. That being, if I'm in a heron fishery and want to declare out of the heron fishery and I'm not fishing for heron and I'm 200 miles away from the demarc line, do I have to go in to do that? You know, whether that's a substantial change or it's not, I'm just asking for some rationalization of why they are in there. One of the other issues in there involved in this is in, if you're out ground fishing on Georges and there's an opening coming, one of the, like May 1st or June 1st, this area opens up and you're already on a trip. You can't go declare into that area. The way it's set now, the boat has to come back through the demarc line to be able to participate or move areas after the declaration. So just to alleviate some of them aspects of it. Main concern is it's kind of an across-the-board thing for this. You got to declare before you leave the demarc, and I understand part of it, but I think we need to look at it fishery by fishery and see whether it's really needed.
Anyone else?
Yeah, I think the next one could be into that same fold. It's about the possession limits on the same.
Rodney, your mic's off. Rodney, before we move on,
we came on flood.
Pat Kirkle had something to say.
I just wanted to agree with John Nelson's suggestion. I see it as the same type of an issue, and we can certainly provide input into that discussion along the lines that Phil is asking, you know, at the committee level.
Okay, one more.
Okay, Rodney.
This one here I think needs to be dealt with now. I don't. This was a motion that the committee moves to inform the council that if a minimum size change, a haddock size change, that law enforcement committee recommends that one consistent size across all areas. And the motion was 4 in favor, 0 opposed, and 1 abstention.
Okay, so this
and
is
that's
this is
to do with the discard of haddock on Georgia's Bank.
Yep.
And the discussion was enforcement would be having problems with two different haddock sizes, one in the Gulf of Maine and one in Georgia's Bank. So the feeling of the committee was the haddock resource was being wasted because of the minimum size, 19 inches, that if they lowered it, the only way it would be enforceable it would be if it was lowered in all areas.
Okay.
And that was the feeling of the committee.
So that's more of advice to the council.
Exactly.
Considering this in
if the committee decides to change it,
okay.
Our recommendation is it go across the board.
Good, thank you. I want to get back to the motion that you had before and go back to John Nelson's comment. I tend to agree with John as well that it would be helpful if your committee could come back to the council, say, in September with a package or a list of suggested changes that we could then review, and if we agree, we can forward either the whole package or whatever parts of it to NIMS and initiate a dialogue there on regulatory changes, unless there's objection. Rather than going piecemeal issue by issue, doing more of a holistic review of VMS and its redundancies and complications and trying to streamline the program across the fisheries. Okay? Phil?
Yeah, I don't have a problem with that, John, except for, I mean, I would hope maybe the service could provide us some of the input to that point at the next meeting so we have some place to go. That's kind of like the gist of it. You know, I mean, we keep batting this ball back and forth, and we got three meetings going back and forth. I ain't sure who the hell's winning this tennis game, but it damn sure ain't us. So we need to, you know, get on with what we need to do, and that seems to be, in my mind, where we are. And to this here, like I said, that was a recommendation. Basically, the service asked for some input, and this is, I think, like Rodney said, what we came up with, although I'm not sure I agree, but that's...
Well, and if I remember correctly, the Enforcement VMS Safety Committee has members from the service on it, right? Okay, so hopefully at your next meeting they'll come prepared to talk about this issue.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anything else, Rodney?
No, that's it. Well, we have... Yeah, to deal with.
This was more of a recommendation, unless the council wants to take action on a recommendation. No. Okay. All right. It's 12:40. Let's say we're going to break for lunch. Dave Gaethel, before we break for lunch.
Yeah, in our package under enforcement, we got a document number 7 that I guess must have just come today because it wasn't in, you know. I just wondered if the committee discussed this at all, the alternative solutions to the declarations in the cold weather, or did the committee not have that document?
The IDR?
Yeah.
Letter dated June 14th.
Right.
Ronnie, did you have this letter yesterday?
No, we didn't have this yesterday.
Okay. Thanks for bringing that to my attention or our attention, Dave. Okay. Phil.
Just one other thing on the day, of course. Like I said, I had something to put on the record. Of course, you can't really read the record, but I got to set it in there anyhow. And it's been handled somewhat, but I do want to make it, because we were talking earlier about, in Bill's presentation, about the 24/7 monitoring and when the outages occur and what have you. And the presentation we did get yesterday, Mr. Pinkerton said we have 0.1% of the performance. That's the outages. I think the system works great. Unless you look at the boats. Then we got like a 40% problem. You know, the number changes kind of radically there. It's very hard to define this outage problem from the presentation, from what the report we got yesterday when you start looking at this, because when you get the 40% number, is one outage in a 24-hour period. So one time in 24 hours, I think the machine didn't blink like it was supposed to, that's a reported outage. Now, they handle, just quick math, I think the number was 24,000 hits a day is what's run on VMS right now. So 40% of that has a problem. So it's not quite as rosy as we, partially heard. But what I wanted for the record was, as far as this 24/7 and watching it, this is my own experience, and it's been handled. It's not a problem, but I need it in the record. That my boat sailed on March 17th this year on a Saturday. My son calls me Sunday evening. He says, I can't get the boat tracks weather to come up. I said, well, he worked on the machine a little bit. I called boat tracks. Machine was froze up. Couldn't do nothing with it. End result was somebody had sent an email, a spam email, come back to my machine and blocked it, stopped it dead. So the machine was down. So Sunday night on March 18th, I called the VMS hotline. And I want to emphasize that. Hotline. They responded Thursday morning on the 22nd. We resolved the issue. It wasn't a major thing. But as far as talking about a 24/7, watching this system and all the expectations we have out of it, I called the national hotline on a Sunday night. I got a return call Thursday morning.
Okay, anything else? Phil?
Just answering David's... Oh, sorry. Bill? You wanted me?
Lou.
Okay.
I've been calling Phil all morning, so...
I thought Bill wanted to respond to that last one, but... David, we got that letter the end of last week. We did have it at the meeting. We had sent a letter to the regional office, which Pat answered, requesting that alternatives to VMS notification be looked at, like IVR, and she came back saying that they would do that, and that people could, if you read that letter, I think it's near the bottom of the first paragraph on the first page, people could alternatively, if they were going to stay with the same declaration as previously, that was the legacy on that machine, would simply use the IVR to call in and start their trip under that rather than waiting for a VMS acknowledgement and so on. The issue Dave is bringing up is, which he brought up previously in describing this situation, was when the machine is shut down because of cold. So he's calling in, or and others are calling in, declaring out a fishery. And then you know, having to start up the machine, warm it up, get it going, send a declaration, wait for acknowledgement, then go fishing. It's very difficult for a day trip. That couldn't be handled under that situation that Pat suggested for some others, simply because you couldn't use the IVR alternative because your legacy code was out of fishery. So obviously you couldn't continue to fish as out of fishery. So that part of that issue still is open. But there is a solution to some of it with the IVR alternative.
I haven't had a chance to read the letter. I'm not sure anyone else on the council has either, but hopefully, Rodney, you'll be able to take this up at your next meeting.
Yes. Sue did address this.
She did.
I thought it was a different letter, but Sue did address this yesterday.
Okay.
This letter.
Right. Dave?
No, I was going to say, I think this is a good start. I mean, this solves a good portion of it. And I think the second part of the solution would be if you intend on changing declarations, you could do it at the end of your last trip when you've got the machine up and running and it's warm. And I think that would be the second part of the solution. Then you don't have to worry about sending it when it's cold. In other words, after you've unloaded from whatever you're in, and you just change your declaration before you shut the machine off, and then you're declared in, and you can use the IVR the next day. So I'm pleased with this letter. I think this is a good start at getting a solution to this problem for next winter.
Okay. Break for lunch. Be back by 2. We're already an hour behind when we get back, so 2 o'clock.